are you and what are you doing here?
Hi, everybody.
Well, what are we waiting for?
This is fantastic.
Hello, hello, hello.
This will only hurt for 22 minutes.
It's very early. I may have to hurt you. Call me in 5 minutes.
This is something that is treatable. This is something that is fixable.
Hey, this is not a test.
Oh, my God, it's early.
Ah, welcome aboard the Amy Beth Arkowi Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are ya? Pretty busy, robust, free-flow pop culture combo. We'll take on the incendiary situation in Baltimore after a very volatile, destructive night of rioting and destruction. The community comes out to clean up and ask for calm. We'll talk about that. Also, revelations from the Bruce Jenner interview. NBC leaking more fabulous stories from Brian Williams. Can he possibly come back from that? And if you're looking for a job, you might want to apply for one as a playdate valet. We'll talk. Also, Tony nominations out today, and yeah, there were a couple of surprises and snubs. We'll talk inspiration to action, challenge success stories, too. Love to get you on the line if you're listening live. It is Tuesday, April 28th, 9 a.m. out west, 11 central, noon here in the east. Number in motion, 347-857-4505. Twitter feed up and running, too, at AB Writes. The show today brought to you in part by Audiophile, from music to books to podcasts. Caress your ears with everything you want to hear from Audiophile. Also, by City Mobile, you can shop almost from anywhere with City Mobile. First of all, let's welcome our guest to the show. You know I always enjoy welcoming fellow authors into the fold, and today's guest is simpatico with me because we both write cozy mysteries, but she's also an accomplished actress. Catherine Lee Scott started her career in the Mad Men era as a Playboy bunny and went on to have a substantial role in the popular gothic soap opera Dark Shadows. Now is featured on a semi-regular basis, I think, on the popular sitcom The Goldbergs as George Segal's girlfriend. So she's had a wide-ranging career, taken some time along the way to write a slew of books about her experiences, one about her Playboy bunny era, a couple about Dark Shadows, and now she's writing these cozy mysteries, the Jinx Fogarty series, Down and Out in Beverly Hills, love that title, and the new one just coming out called Jinx. So it's such a pleasure and an honor to have you here, Catherine Lee Scott. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, that's a wonderful introduction. Thank you so much, Amy.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm so happy you're here. We have so much to talk about. I mean, how your acting informs your writing and vice versa, and of course I can see from the books, the new books, the series, the Jinx Fogarty series, how you take your Hollywood background and employ it, as well as your own experience in Hollywood as an actress through various stages of your life. And you have this character, Meg Barnes, who played Jinx Fogarty, who's an amateur detective on a popular series, and she thinks she's going to get the gig as they revamp the show, but they kind of push her aside and ask her to coach a younger actress. So that's kind of a humbling experience. Talk about how you got to write these mysteries after all these other endeavors that you were involved in.
Well, you know, I've always been a writer and an actor. I started out that way at the very beginning of my career. It's just that I got more work as an actress, and of course, that kind of led the way. But I started writing fiction about 5 years ago. This is after 30-some years of writing nonfiction, magazine articles to all sorts of books, and I finally, when I wrote the Return to Collinwood, which was really about five decades of Dark Shadows, I thought, you know, I've said all I can in nonfiction. I'm going to turn this into fiction, and I wrote Dark Passages with sort of a wink and a nod to Dark Shadows.
Oh, very cool. I haven't seen that one yet, but that sounds very intriguing to do that.
Yeah, that was the first book that I wrote. I had a lot of fun with it, a paranormal mystery. And then, Amy, I turned to really cozy fiction with the Jinx Fogarty series, and I love writing Jinx.
Yeah, there's a lot of her, or a lot of you, I guess, in her, right? I mean,
she's
funky,
yes.
She's fun. Yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing is that I've, actresses reach a certain age and the work is less available. And I write about all of that sort of inner life of a working actress. But also, I've known a few people who've just fallen on really hard times. And as you know, Meg Barnes is homeless and hiding it. She is living on the streets of Beverly Hills in her, she calls it her Ritz Volvo. And that's really the fun part of it, because it's like Murder, She Wrote. The mysteries come to her. She solves a mystery. Her first mystery, of course, is tracking down her fugitive husband, who is the reason why she is homeless in the first place.
Why she's homeless, yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. It's interesting because you do, of course, you have what we all do in the cozy mystery genre, which is incorporate humor and the quirky characters and all that light touch. But you also have those serious subjects that are underlying, like you said, the homelessness, the idea that her husband who ran away with money and kind of
I'm sure you know people like this too, but it takes so little, you know, to make things go bad. I mean, a career meltdown or catastrophic health issue. There are so many reasons why people can end up losing everything. In this case, it's a marriage that went very wrong. She married a man who turned out to be a con man, a second marriage that should have been the love of her life. So she's dealing with huge betrayal, but it's something I'm a little bit familiar with because I've worked in a homeless program in Beverly Hills, and yes, everybody wonders if there are homeless people in Beverly Hills. There are, and
yes.
I've met a number of women. You would never know that they were homeless. They're actually, smartly dressed and nicely made up, but they are living in their cars, and they are hugely resourceful. They find a way in public restrooms and, makeup counters and department stores to keep themselves well-groomed.
Yeah, it's so interesting because those are people that had something before, so they do have some clothes to fall back on and that kind of thing so they can present themselves, but yet you would think they would have a hard time being so resourceful because they were so used to maybe living a different kind of lifestyle and then have to do it. So it is sort of the human spirit of finding a way and doing that.
Yes,
and certainly Meg is very resourceful.
Which I find sort of uplifting. I really do. It's Meg is clearly not going to stay homeless for long. She is very resourceful. She's going to find a way to pull herself up by the bootstraps, and she does.
She does.
I found that really interesting. In other words, the whole premise of the book was, let's take a woman who has everything and wipe the slate clean, leave her with nothing. What do you do? And as a writer yourself, you know what they always say, put the protagonist up a tree and start throwing rocks.
Right, right.
Put a dog barking at the bottom, a thunderstorm, whatever.
Yeah, there's always some obstacles, and a murder helps, a murder along the way that she can help solve,
Exactly.
Certainly helps. So there's this, all the suspension of disbelief that you have to have when you read one of these books, but at the same time, you're getting some serious stuff in there.
The new one, Jinxed, the sequel to Down and Out in Beverly Hills, puts her on another path. That's the one that you were talking about at the very beginning. And again, that's something else I'm familiar with. I mean, I originated the roles of Josette Dupre and Maggie Evans on Dark Shadows. So what is that like when the show is redone, as it just was? I was in the film with Johnny Depp that Tim Burton directed.
Oh, yeah.
And what is that like to see another actress who's 22 years old, which is really my age when I was doing Dark Shadows, what is that like to see somebody else playing the role that you originated? So that was another jumping off place for the new book.
What was that like?
Well, first of all, she was completely charming. Her name was something, Bella Heathcote, I guess. She's an Australian gal. But, she was completely lovely, but there is that little pang, and you just think, oh, will she get it right? Will she,
the tone,
or whatever. But it was a weird experience, and that was my jumping-off point for Jinxed. And what I'm really delighted, and I'm glad we're speaking today, is that both of these books are on Amazon promotions this month up through May 17th.
Oh, great. So people can get their hands on them for
one
a nice price.
The Jinxed is $2.99, and Down and Out is $1.99. So it's a great way to download and sample both books.
And get into it. Exactly. You fall into this.
Yeah.
It's funny because you were on Dark Shadows, which was like a cult classic, and I'm sure there are still people, still fans, right? Because one of those shows that people just love, like Star Trek, So I'm sure
you hear
from fans all the time, right?
That's right. We're celebrating our 49th anniversary this year. We've got our 50th, of course, coming up.
Big doings, I'm guessing, for next year, yeah?
Big doings. And there really are a great many fans. It's a platform I have that I very much respect. I mean, these are people who have stayed interested in the show all of these years, but we also have two new generations that have come along. So I actually hear from 14-year-olds who are just sampling Dark Shadows now on DVD.
Oh, how fun.
It is.
How fun
is
that, right? I mean,
well, it is.
And really cool.
Really Dark Passages. I mean, I just thought of all of the things that I know about behind the scenes working in a soap in the 1960s. I've just got to have some fun with that.
Wow, very cool. I mean, you have a lot of good work and good experience to draw from, you know, all those details that you can put into it and your perspective. And you obviously have a good sense of humor, I think, and a grounded feeling about what it's like to go through all these changes. And you're pretty honest about it. I mean, you started out very young. You were a Playboy bunny. I mean, wow, what was that like? I mean, that is something which
wonderful.
I guess.
Wonderful. First of all,
did you really like it?
I did.
Yeah, because a lot of people malign that experience now.
Gloria
right?
Steinem, you know. I was in,
she was doing it undercover for her article, though, right?
She was doing it undercover, exactly, but I did take bunny training with Gloria Steinem, who was 10 years older and had a completely different outlook on it. So, again, when I wrote The Bunny Years, I really searched out 300 or so women who covered the whole 25-year history of Playboy and really wrote a book from their perspective, an honest point of view, because I thought that Gloria's was very soured. And she came with an agenda. I just decided that I could not let that be the gospel of the way things were, because it was really quite different for many of these women, including Deborah Harry, Lauren Hutton, Susan Sullivan, all of them friends, all of them former bunnies I worked with. For them, it was a launching pad, and for me as well. So it was.
Now, did you know? Did you know?
Side of the story.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting. I got to read that book. Did you know? That Gloria Steinem was working undercover at the time, or she didn't let on?
No, as a matter of fact, I really liked her. I mean, we sat in the bunny dressing room. We had dinner together a couple of times. She knew that I was a scholarship student, that I was, you know, very ambitious and was a writer and an actor and so on. So I was really dismayed when her article came out, the two-part article in Show Magazine. Because so were the other women in the club. We were all very disappointed because, you know, it's one thing to diss the company that you work for. It's quite another to diss the women you work with and to treat us like, you know, bimbos when every one of us was as ambitious as she was herself was just hugely disappointing.
Well, and all the women you mentioned who became famous certainly were not bimbos.
Good
every God, last one
no.
of them.
I mean, try calling Lauren Hutton a bimbo.
Yeah.
No, I mean, and Susan Sullivan, oh, my God, she take your head off. No, I mean, these are not bimbos. these were women who were going to college, who were using the opportunity to make something of themselves. And there were so many other women, all of whom are in this book, a good 300 or so women, from the very first bunny who opened the Chicago Club in February of 1960 to the very last three bunnies who closed the New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago clubs. So it's a very explosive period of time, especially for women, that 25-year period. I mean, the arc for women is extraordinary. It was everything from sex, drugs, rock and roll through the ERA. Remember the ERA age?
And, they tried,
all the way up to 1985. That was interesting.
They tried, and we're still trying to get equal pay. That's a whole other issue. But I mean, think about it, because it seems like a demoralizing thing. And of course, you know, if you watch like Mad Men, you see what happened, and you know how women were treated and how they triumphed in many cases. Some of the characters do triumph, but they have to
grin
and bear it.
And to triumph. And here's the point.
Yeah.
Many of the women who were working as Playboy bunnies at that time were making more money than their fathers. Working as Playboy bunnies. They certainly made more money than any man working in that club. They made more money than the room directors who were ostensibly their managers. So there were a lot of things that I think Gloria overlooked. However, the costume demeaning, of course it was. And the fact that only men could be members of the club, that changed in the 1970s. I mean, there were so many little things that kept changing incrementally, but we were there. We were there. We made it happen.
Yeah. And you just sort of made peace with the idea that you said you waited, right? Did you wait in your mind? This is going to
be
not thrilled that I'm doing it, but I know I'm going to get a benefit out of it. I'm going to get paid. I'm going to get recognized. Maybe I'll make connections. I mean, was that kind of a calculation in your head when you did it?
Yeah, it was. And also the fact that you were working with all of these very motivated women. I mean, we were all 18, 19, 20 years old. I mean, we had a lot of fun. We were a handful. I mean, we knew that we were the reason why people came to the club. And, you treated it like a stage. And I was a schoolgirl who would throw, you know, my saddle shoes and pleated skirt in the locker and put on a bunny costume. Is that not fun? It was terrific. The best place in the world at that time was the bunny dressing room. I loved those women, and many of them are still close friends today.
That's great. So you really treated it like an acting role, and as you said, it was like a launching pad for you.
It was just plain fun, and it was an entry level job. You knew you were going to leave the job. You weren't certainly going to work as a Playboy bunny until you collected Social Security. I mean, that was not going to happen. So no, it was good.
But they got to a certain point where they aged out, right? Was that also part of it? And they had
absolutely
a series they tried to make. Which
did
you see that show, the Playboy? You know, I think it was called Playboy or Playboy Club. They tried it on NBC. It only lasted like a couple of weeks, but it was fascinating, and they yanked it off.
It was fascinating. I thought that they should have told the story from the women's point of view, and the idea of killing a man by stabbing him with a 4-inch stiletto high heel, I thought got the show off to kind of a bad start. It's the idea of really telling the story from the women's point of view is the fun stuff. And they didn't do that. They mixed in so much other stuff. I mean, the women...
Yeah, they weren't sure.
The
I guess that was the big... They couldn't figure out what kind of a show it was going
to
be.
It didn't last long. But, you know, there you are.
Exactly. But
I did do... Someday, if you ever have a chance to watch it, I produced a 2-hour documentary for A&E, and that is the real gritty behind-the-scenes world of the world of Playboy Bunnies over that 25-year period. It was based on the book, and the whole idea is that, you know, these women use it as a launching pad and moved on, and life happens.
Interesting. Is that also called The Bunny Years? Because we could probably find it on DVD.
It's called The Bunny Years, and it's a 2-hour documentary, and I'm sure that, you know, Google it, and you can find it somewhere. But,
yeah, I'm sure we can find it on DVD.
It was really fun. And Deborah Harry, Lauren Hutton, Susan Sullivan, and many of the other women featured in the book are also in the documentary.
Great. What a great bunch of women you just rattled off, and I'm sure there are others as well. But
oh, my God, yes. I mean, there was a rocket scientist. Literally, there were a couple of women who ran for Congress, and I don't remember.
Oh, really?
Do you remember Kimba Wood?
Oh, no.
Remember? She was going to be selected as, I think, was it Obama? No, Clinton, to be a judge.
Oh, okay. Maybe
buddy.
I don't.
Oh, yeah. I'm going. I mean, so women got in. There were women who went into politics, ran for Congress. They were Playboy bunnies, executives at the networks, film producers, film director. They were all Playboy bunnies.
Well, that's so interesting. That was a launching pad for people, and actually the doing of it, like the way you describe it, if you have the right attitude about it, could have given
you
a real sense of power too.
Did you
get to meet
Hugh
Hefner?
You know, I never met him when I was a bunny, but when I did the book, he was intrigued, and he never interfered editorially at all. What he did say was, if you want to get it right, you can use my library. So when my book was essentially finished, I actually had the privilege of using his personal library at the Playboy Mansion West. It's like 1,200 volumes of material. And I could fact check everything. It was really a great opportunity. So I've got pretty good feelings about the guy. And I wish he would make it more public what he has done for film restoration and many other causes that are, you know, kind of dear to my heart.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah.
kind of let himself become a caricature, though, with his, you know,
well, you know,
twin wives and reality show and that kind of thing.
Yeah, but that's his platform. And I just wish, in fact, I have said it to him, I wish people knew more about some of the other things that you are doing. But there you are. I mean, it's his life.
Exactly. Right. You have to worry about your life and the lives of the characters you're creating. You know, you can't take on everybody, but but you gave him a nice plug, which is good. I mean, talk a little bit. Now you're doing a recurring role. I have to say, I don't think I've seen you yet. I've seen a couple of the Gophers, which is a very funny show.
I was in the first season and hope to be invited back. I completely love George Segal. I mean, the guy is 80 years old doing wonderful physical comedy.
Yeah, he's great. He really is.
Boy, is he good. He is so sharp. He is just really neat to work with. I love it. And, of course, my role is a funny one because, you know, he asks me out again and again, and every time it looks like he's going to get lucky and I blow him off. And it's very, I mean.
Well, maybe they got to write you the part where you say, yes, I'll go out, and then you'll become a regular feature on the show.
That would be funny. But he's a lot of fun to work with. I really enjoy the guy. So that's been a lot of fun. And then I also played a role in Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Now, Joss Whedon, and I think he's hugely creative. But I was invited to play a guest star role on that series, and I really loved it. I mean, it's all special effects. I mean, you're playing a scene, and all of a sudden the prop man is putting little dots of masking tape on your face because those are the pointers where, you know, your face is going to be suddenly encrusted in something. You know. I mean, it's all special effects. It's really fun.
That's fun. So talk about obviously you have, as I said, you're flexible because you have to be in your profession over the years. You've grown through the different stages. You started out very young, and now you moved on in life. So have things changed in terms of the way you're treated as a woman? And as you said, sometimes it's not a very forgiving or kind business as women, and sometimes men, too, get older, but especially women.
Well, here is one of the things that I learned both as a Playboy bunny and as a young actress, you know, on a set. You really are responsible for sending up the right signals, letting people know how you want to be treated. If you do it with humor and a certain amount of charm, it goes a long way. But the point is, it's up to you to let people know how you want to be treated. I've never had a casting couch situation. I've never given the signal that I would be open to something like that. I think that's whatever profession you go into, whether you're an entry level secretary or working your way up the ladder. You got to do that. I mean, there's a huge improvement. I've been around for a long time, and I certainly felt as though I was in the vanguard of the women's movement. We called it women's lib back then, and it had to do with equal pay and equal opportunity in the workplace. I felt that I was absolutely in the vanguard of that, and I've seen the changes over the years, and things are improving. I mean, I feel that way. I hope you do, too. There's still more.
I think
to be
so. Although we're still fighting for pay equity in 2015, it seems a little crazy, but I know.
Listen, that one experience that I had, and believe it or not, it happened in England. But I was working on a film project with an actor. We both happened to be doing leading roles in West End productions. I was doing Harvey with Jimmy Stewart, and the guy was working in another play in another theater. But he was getting paid more than me on this project. And and I had more scenes, more lines, you know, a bigger role. And I complained about it, and the casting director, who was a woman, said, "But Catherine, he's got a family."
Oh, I know. They always say that.
I couldn't believe it. I'm going back decades with this story. But it was one of those things that it just slaps you in the face and you think, what are they thinking? So, I've stood up for myself along the way, and I think that's what you need to do. And slowly, incrementally, the changes are there.
Yeah. I mean, Bette Davis was on the forefront of that. I mean, she was the first actress to, like, walk out, you know, and demand
a higher
salary and so forth. But it is, you know, it's, you're right. I mean, incremental changes are great. Everything is better than nothing, but it, you would think we would have been farther along by this point and that you still have some people at the throwback who think, well, we're going to pay the guy more because he does have family. It's like, well, but a lot of women now are the people that bring home the bacon for their families, you know. So that kind of doesn't make sense anymore. Not that it ever did, but.
No, it's the dumbest response. And, yes, there is a double standard, and we recognize it. But here's the really interesting thing. In the beginning of the women's movement, there was such a contentiousness between men and women in the very beginning. And I don't see that now. I don't see it among my nieces and nephews. I don't see it among the young people. And I have a great many young friends. The attitude has changed. They're, men are in it along with women. There's a different dynamic between the younger generations of men and women.
I think you're right.
I see it reflected in the attitudes of my nephews.
That's great. That's a good thing. But I think you're also probably very helpful to young people coming up, younger actors who see you on the set and how you handle yourself. I'm sure you know, I don't want to put pressure on you to be a role model because, you know, that's a lot of pressure.
You are absolutely correct. It is, when you go on a set and you're professional and the way you conduct yourself and your treatment of your fellow actors and your fellow team, that all communicates itself and it is completely vital. It's completely vital that we do that.
And collaboration is key, and you obviously know a lot about that because that's a hallmark in
and
writing, although I've done plays as a playwright, and certainly when you get into the theater and you see the amount of work and effort that the director and the actors use for your words, it's humbling and it's gratifying.
I like being collaborative, and the one area where I'm really my own whatever team is when I'm writing fiction. And that's just you facing the blank screen and coming up with a story and letting your imagination run. But the two professions, writing and acting, really do, for me, feed each other. Everything I've ever learned as an actor, I put into the writing, and I think I came into acting because of, you know, language and it was my way of communicating. Yeah.
So all great compliments to each other, which is fabulous.
Absolutely.
And it works. It seems to work for you. Tell us a little bit about your schedule, because how do you juggle all this stuff? Because a lot of our listeners are aspiring actors or writers, particularly writers.
Well,
how do you do it?
Well, if you think about it, and, you know, I ran a book publishing company for 29 years, Pomegranate Press. So, I've worked as an editor. And so if you go on Amazon and just Google Catherine Lee Scott, you'll see the other books. And I've published books primarily from other authors. I've published a few of my own nonfiction, but most of them are by other authors. And I find that most of what I do, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. Publishing is a series of small jobs. Acting, there's a length of time that you're going to be working on something. Even a book. A book has its life, from its genesis until, you know, the time you turn it into your editor. And I find that I'm able to juggle. In fact, I very often work on two writing projects at the same time, one fiction, one nonfiction. I just, when I feel a bump in the road in one, I just turn to the other.
Right. So you're keeping the whole thing, all the neurons moving and you in forward motion. So
here's the real secret, 1,000 words a day.
There you go. So you stick to that. You adhere to that?
Yes.
Okay.
I write 1-inch margins, 4 pages.
Okay. And you get it done. And the thing is, even if they're not good pages, that's okay, because you're in that process and something good's going to come, right? Eventually, you know that's going to kick in.
Well, yeah, because there again, I'm used to rehearsal. And writing the first draft is rehearsal. And then you go back and you polish. And, that's rewriting. So
exactly,
the two professions are not dissimilar.
Yeah, there was definitely a connection. I see that. And again, what you're pointing out, too, is that small bites. You know, give yourself small goals each day, whether it's 1,000 pages or, I mean, 1,000 words. 1,000 pages would be a lot. Maybe J.K. Rowling could pull that one off. I don't know. But,
and
you know,
I think
give yourself...
you know that, too. Imagine you look at a book and you think, I got to write this. No.
No, of course not. Well,
all you have to do is write the first page.
But that's when people get nervous about it. Like I have students or clients I work with as a creativity coach and teacher, and they'll get panicky. I can't think of it. I said, don't think of writing the whole book. You got to just, you know, one page at a time, one chapter at a time, and you'll see how it'll evolve. If you take on the whole book on the first day, you're never going to get it done because it's way too daunting.
This is true.
It'll just sit there, you know. But it's fascinating. So you do, even if you're doing an acting job, you still get the pages in, or do you take time off at that point?
Well, you know, I'm going to a writer's conference this weekend. I know I'm not going to get any writing done. And so I do every once in a while just have to take a break. But I've been known to sit in my dressing room with my laptop. You know what it's like on a set? You're waiting for
to
set up the scene. Right. I just go to my dressing room and log on do some writing. You know,
you're like in a creative zone. You got yourself in that mindset or a creative mindset where you're always thinking about it. The character's always in your head, I'm guessing, and you're just at the ready to get into it. Are you planning more Jinx Fogarty's? Do you think she's going to be up for more tricks?
Yes, I think I'm going to set the next one in London. I lived in London for many years, and I know London so well. I thought that would be a great place to take Jinx, so I am going to do that. I finished another book that my editor has. It's called Last Dance at the Savoy. It's sort of a nonfiction book. We'll see what my agent, if she has any luck with that. But I'm always writing. And then I've got another standalone, just mainstream fiction, women's fiction, that I'm about two-thirds of the way through.
Wow, you're busy. You're a busy woman. Keep doing it, and it's great.
I mean, I love it.
Energized.
And look at all the things you juggle.
Yeah, I know. I do. But I'm sometimes I'm amazed at that, too.
I know. But we do it. I think,
yeah.
I think, frankly, women have that gift. I think that we are able to juggle a lot of things at one time, and we have to. You know,
and if you like what you're doing, it's not so much work. And also you get energized by it. So one thing leads to the other because you have that energy and you're ready to go. I think that's part of it. I think people get inertia sets in, I think, when people are not happy with what they're doing, frankly, and when you just feel like there's no way out, there's nothing to do. But the good thing about creativity is no matter what your situation is, you can plug into it and you can, kind of talk yourself out or write yourself out of it in some ways. You can give yourself that permission to do it. You know, that's the beauty of writing, more so than acting, because acting you kind of are dependent on other people offering you jobs and that kind of thing. But you can, you know, as you said, fire up the laptop or whip out the pad. I tend to write most of my first drafts on a pad and pen, which is interesting.
That's a lot of people do, and I just recently I've done it even lately, but I'm now I head straight for the laptop. But no, it's a good way to start.
Yeah, well, I like that soul pen paper connection. I think is there, but my handwriting is dreadful. My listeners know I always say I need a Rosetta Stone to read my own handwriting, so it encourages me to get to the computer to do the next draft quickly, so I can remember what I wrote. But I do think there's that kind of connection. But whatever it is, whatever works for you, you can get there and do it. You're not really dependent on anybody else, at least initially. Then you are later when you have to worry about getting it published and all that. But that's this next step, you know, after you write it. So. It's fascinating. Well, I'm congratulations on the new Jinx Fogarty's. I know a lot of people enjoy them.
Go to Amazon. They are available. They're on sale. They're a good Mother's Day gift, whatever. But they're on sale. So now's a good time to dip in. Yeah.
Perfect time to dip in, and they'll, you know, you'll catch it. You'll get addicted to them, and then you'll be ready for the next one, right?
Well, there you go. God, it's good talking to you. I think you're terrific.
Well, thank you so much, Catherine Lee Scott. A pleasure. I'm gonna find out more about the bunny years and the documentary in that book, too, because that sounds fascinating. It's a little piece of pop culture history that a lot of people, I'm sure, would be fascinated with.
You bet.
And you also have a website we should mention, CatherineLeeScott.com. The Lee is L-E, K-A-T-H-R-Y-N-L-E-I-G-H.
I know I have an odd spelling. It's K-A-T-H-R-Y-N-L-E-I-G-H-S-E-O-T-T. .com. Please go to the site because there's a lot of stuff on it, not just books.
Yeah, well, I'll post the link for people on my Twitter feed too, so people can go.
That would be great. Thank you so much.
Get a look at it. Catherine Lee Scott, a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on. Best of luck with the Jinx Fogarty stories, and I hope more folks check them out. Thanks so much. I hope you come back and see us again.
Thank you. All right. Bye bye.
Take care. Bye bye. Again, find out more at CatherineLeeScott.com. It is the end of the Dark Weekly Show. Reach out via Twitter, AB Wright, phone line 347-857-4505.
There's a formula to it. A very simple formula. Everybody's a suspect.
Television on. That's Billy Joel, of course, and the Dark Shadows theme in honor of our guest, Catherine Lee Scott, who had a pivotal role on that classic goth soap opera. 50th anniversary next year. That should be a big wing ding. Lots of fans of that show still. and find out more about Catherine Lee Scott. Her Bunny Years documentary and book sounds fascinating. I've got to Google that and see if we can find that, because that should be really intriguing. And the new books, the Jinx Fogarty series, the latest of which is Jinx, the first one, Down and Out in Beverly Hills. Find out more. You can get them at Amazon.com or find out more about her works at her website, CatherineLeeScott.com. I said I will post it, and I will after the show on our Twitter feed, so you can just click it and find out more about her. On the Twitter feed here at AB Writes, one of our hardy regulars, Nixie, chiming in. Another fabulous interview. This woman sounds fascinating, and the book sounds good, too. Yeah, well, go check it out, Nixie. I think you'll enjoy it. Dottie chiming in. Another great interview. Great style. And Panache, you both have. Well, thank you so much. I think you'll enjoy the books. And finding out more about her. What a fascinating woman. A great career, rich career, and so much intriguing terrain that she has traversed over the years. I mean, Playboy Bunny enough right there is such a cultural, iconic time and place and persona. And that documentary sounds really intriguing. And Dark Shadows, of course, a cult classic. And kids are learning about it. It's fun, I guess, to be involved in something so iconic that people generations after generation will look at it. And what a great attitude she has about working in this business for all these years and, you know, getting older in an industry that's not always forgiving, but finding a way to make it because of her own attitude and approach to the craft and to her fellow actors and directors and, you know, working with people who are like kids now for her. You know, there must be some, you know, sometimes not such great experiences that could happen, but if you have the right approach and the right attitude, you can triumph over anything and inform that, you know, change the tide and the tone of the workplace. It's interesting. Think about that. You know, I think she's pointed out, you know, we have more control than we think. We don't have control over everything. You don't always have control over things like pay equity. You don't always have control over the way people treat you. But if you put out a certain vibe, if you hold yourself a certain way, if you talk to people a certain way, I think you can get your point across and you can make your situation better and sometimes better for other people, too. Again, no pressure, but sometimes the workplace, the right people at the right time can help other people who might be struggling along. So think about that. And sometimes you just have to get out if it's a really bad situation, but that's a whole other issue. Speaking of bad issues, that Baltimore situation, wow, what a volatile night in Baltimore. The riots that started the springboard was that horrible death of Eddie Gray, the young man that was arrested and then mysteriously developed a spinal injury and then finally died in that police van. Not even sure why he was arrested. A big investigation going out. Allegedly a report coming out at the end of the week. If they don't like what they hear in the report, some people are worried there'll be more volatility. But to take to the streets, and there's a lot of reasons why this happens. This kind of harkens back, and I'm too young to really remember this, but in the late 60s when they had all those eruptions that summer when Newark and Oakland and all these places went up, and they were burning down the cities because of frustration, because of inequality, because of poverty, because of joblessness. We're kind of back there now. There's a lot of police brutality, we can't deny it, that affects particularly the black community in this country. You know, from Ferguson to Staten Island to South Carolina to Baltimore. I mean, Baltimore is notorious. I mean, the HBO series The Wire indicated all the police corruption and brutality that went on in that city. A homicide before that, also a David Simon series, also reflected some of the inequities in that city. And the poverty and the unemployment rate for young people, it's outrageous. And, you know, we're at a tipping point, I guess, where things have got to change. But taking to the streets and destroying and being violent, especially in your own, well, anywhere, but in your own community, these people are tearing down their own businesses, businesses of their neighbors. And it is so outrageous, so pathetic. You see this woman, I'm sure this went viral, you probably saw this on the news, a mother running after when she saw her son being involved in the riots, ran after him and grabbed him and kind of slapped him around, which, of course, a lot of child advocates are going to be mad about that, and I understand that, but the anger of just, well, how are you involved in this? What are you doing? You burned out a CVS where people are working in that neighborhood. People rely on that as a drugstore and also a small grocery store for people who can't get to bigger grocery stores. I mean, there's not a lot of people who have cars there, and transportation may be shaky, and some have an elderly population. I saw somebody on talking about that and how outrageous this is. You're destroying your own businesses. Today, the business owners and the community came out to clean up all the debris and to try to start rebuilding the way they did in Ferguson when they burned down Ferguson. It's just really outrageous. Al Sharpton has been dispatched. He says he's been asked to come down to help calm things. Let's hope he doesn't stir the pot, because we don't need that, that's for sure. We don't need to escalate. But it's another situation, and we do then have to look at, it's wrong how they're doing it and what they're going about, the protests that are the riots that they're starting and doing. But you have to look at the problems, the underlying problems. Again, police brutality, poverty, joblessness, particularly among young people. They have a curfew now, and they canceled school, so a lot of people were concerned, well, the kids are home from school with nothing to do but fester their rage while their parents are at work, because most of these people can't afford to take a day off to stay home with their kids. I mean, it's just a cyclical problem, and hopefully the call for calm will be heeded and some changes will be made, but these riots are not the way to go. Peaceful protest is one thing. Rioting and looting and destroying property and fires and all that is just not good. Just not good. Any thoughts on that? Reach out via Twitter, AB Writes, phone line 2347-857-4505 if you're listening live. Did you see, as we switched topics, the Bruce Jenner interview? So many people watched that Diane Sawyer interview with Bruce Jenner. It was not nearly as exploitive or salacious as maybe we thought it might be. It was actually pretty intriguing and informative, and probably will. You know, he says he's going to change the world with this and help people. He probably will help a lot of people, because there are a lot of people in the shadows who struggle with gender dysphoria. And to see someone who was certainly an Olympic star and an icon for years before he was attached to this Kardashian nonsense, which unfortunately has become kind of a reality joke. But he's got a lot of support from his family, which is intriguing. He's got a lot of kids, apparently. I mean, he's got six kids through three marriages of his own, and then he's got four stepkids. He's got 10 kids and a bunch of grandkids, I guess, at this point. And, you know, he was married three times. He says he's not. It's interesting because it's so confusing sometimes when you think about this, because he says he's heterosexual. He's always been attracted to women, but if he is a woman and he's attracted to women, then that would make him a lesbian. So it's sort of very intriguing and confounding sometimes to think about it. And people will say, well, why do you have to do it now? I guess you just can't live the lie anymore. And that's what it is. It's, you want to be in your own skin and feel like you're in your own skin, even if you're 65 years old, you know, and all these years of dogging it and backburnering it and trying to shield, you know, cover it up, ignore it. You can't ignore who you are. You just can't, which is why it's so great to get these things out from the shadows. Gay issues, and this is not a gay issue per se, although the LGBT community, they put in the gay, you know, transgender with the gay community, they're all different things, but the acceptance is true with a lot of people, got themselves, and still probably to this day, but not as many, would force themselves into heterosexual marriages because they didn't want to admit they were gay to themselves or to their family or to the public. And then, but at some point in their lives, how many stories have you heard, public and otherwise, of people midlife who just can't take it anymore because they just can't live that lie? You have to be true to who you are. And the sooner you do it, frankly, the better off you're going to be, and the other people in your lives who you're impacting are going to be as well. If you know early on that you need to have reassignment surgery or live as the gender you believe you were born to be, but you know biology screwed it up somehow, then you need to do that earlier before you get married and start having all these kids. Although, of course, the kids are here now, so that becomes a whole other issue. But anyway, what is your take? Anybody have any comments about the Bruce Jenner interview? AB Writes is the place to go. Phone line, too, if you happen to be listening live. I'm always asking you, cling those tin cans in a string together, 347-857-4505. I thought it was fascinating. The biggest revelation, Bruce Jenner's a Republican. And it was funny because he said, yeah, is there anything wrong with that? And Diane Sawyer said, no, but do you think Mitch McConnell and John Boehner are going to be open to these kinds of ideas? And he said, yeah, I think they would. Well, maybe on a personal note. I think that's always the way. Politics, you see, start with the personal, the political can then follow. That's why the acceptance of gay marriage has become even widely accepted among some Republicans, at least rank-and-file Republicans, younger people particularly who might affiliate with the Republican Party. Older people, and particularly the politicians, are not so much on board yet. But it's only a matter of time, and the same thing could be said for the transgender community as well. So kudos to Bruce Jenner. I'm not so sure I want to see a six- or eight-part documentary series of him going through the transformation, although, you know, if it's done tastefully, if it's not done like a Kardashian, low-rent reality show, although I have to admit I haven't really seen that reality show. I've seen other reality shows, and none of them are done with what we should say, great integrity or documentary standards. But this one might be. This one might be. So we'll see. We'll give him a chance to see if that's true. It seems a little bit like secondhand news, but not quite. Brian Williams, will he be coming back to NBC? There are some people that want him to come back. I don't see how it can possibly happen. Given what we now know, there are more revelations that say at least 10 or 11 times some fabulous stories have emerged from Brian Williams, and that just seems credibility is a key, and I don't see it happening. Although I did see Michael Wolff, who's a columnist with Vanity Fair, on one of the Sunday morning shows 2 weeks ago, talking about, oh, yeah, he's definitely going to come back because we're all about personality now and nothing happened to O'Reilly. O'Reilly, Williams, two different positions. O'Reilly may be a bloviator and a fabulist, but he's on Fox News as a commentator. People like him. They watch him. Facts are not the main issue why they watch him. Now, he can say he sticks with the facts. That's his choice. But when you go to a straight news anchor, the only thing you have left in the straight news chair, and believe me, they don't have a lot of as much of a viewership as they once had. They still have a big viewership. They have a bigger viewership than cable still. But it's dwindling, and it's dwindling precipitously, and by age, the older people, older demo, will watch the news a lot more than the younger demo in terms of the network news. But credibility is the only thing you have. That's your calling card if you're a network anchor, and I just don't see how he can make it back as a network anchor. I think if they want to bring him back, hey, there are other things he could do, maybe a late-night talk show, commentary pieces. Fine. He's a likable fellow. He did do some fine reporting, I guess, in his day. But no, I don't see him being an anchor anymore. I mean, I think Lester Holt is doing a decent job. I think their ratings slipped a little bit here and there, but I think the ratings will slip much further if they bring him back. I mean, that's my opinion. Otherwise, are people just watching it because they like him? Why do you watch the news? Because you like the guy who's reading the news? I mean, it's just, I mean, that's part of it. But if you're doubting that the guy is giving you the straight story, I think you're going to go elsewhere. And I think ABC and CBS would be doing handsprings over his return. That's my opinion. I don't know. Your take, love to hear it. AB Writes is the Twitter feed handle. A phone line, of course, 347-857-4505. Good job.
Yeah. coat and grabbed my hat. Made the bus in seconds flat. Found my way upstairs and had a smoke. And somebody spoke and I went into a dream.
Reflecting a day in the life in the tabloids and the news. On the end of the Third Kiwi Show, also secondhand news from Fleetwood Mac as we reflect on the Brian Williams situation. Busy on the Twitter feed regarding that, and Davey writes, Cheryl chiming in, thought he should have gone from the beginning. Vinny, pull the plug already. Tanya, don't see him back in that chair, no way, no how. And Scoop says, forgive and forget, but not as the anchor. Yeah, maybe there's something else he can do. I'm saying, maybe a late-night talk show, I'm sure. You know, don't hold a benefit for Brian Williams. He's amassed plenty of money, and they'll probably buy him out, although he's on a unpaid leave, and there should be something in his contract, a clause, a morality clause or something, that if he does something to hurt his performance, that he shouldn't be paid. But they'll negotiate it, no doubt, if they want him out, I'm sure. But he's got plenty of money anyway, and he'll probably write a memoir and go on the Mea Culpa talk show tour. So be it. But I don't see him behind the anchor desk. If they do bring him back, it's a grubby ratings grab, and I think he'll backfire. And it will just show what a shambles NBC, and particularly the news division, is in. We'll see what happens. I think the inside sources say that they will make this decision soon, because I think it's May 11th is the date when NBC has their big fall reveal. That's when they talk about the upcoming shows, what shows made the cut and didn't, and I think they want to kind of not have the Brian Williams decision overshadow all of that. We'll see. You don't know. But there was reports last week that were leaked by somebody at NBC, which is an indication if somebody's leaking the story that somebody wants it out, which to me indicates, and I could be wrong, but they're setting the groundwork for pulling the plug. Because there were apparently at least 10 or 11 incidences of him exaggerating his stature and what he was doing in a particular story. There were a couple of people that came to his defense and said, well, sometimes you don't have the right memory and, you know, you can't recount exactly what happened under stressful situations. And that may be true, but it's interesting and that every time he doesn't remember it correctly, he's in a better position than he was in. In other words, he's in greater danger or he's up close and more personal to the situation than he was in reality. If he really just was a faulty memory situation where he just didn't quite remember it right, sometimes he might have been in a or background situation. You know what I'm saying? He's always putting himself further, and, you know, he's always there. It's like Forrest Gump. He's always at the scene. So, you know, there's something going on there that's not quite kosher, and I think I just don't see him as a news anchor. I don't know. This is my take on it. I know there's some conflicts. Most people that have chimed in today agree with me, but I've heard other people on the other side who say, oh, what's the big deal? And he just, you know, he didn't really hurt anybody and that kind of thing. Although they have a fan club, apparently. They've got a Facebook page, Bring Back Brian Williams, and they had on one of the Sunday shows, I think it was the reliable sources on CNN two Sundays ago when they had Michael Wolff on, who said he's pretty sure he's coming back, and I was sort of aghast at that watching the show. They had a few fans from the Facebook page, gals who really like Brian Williams, but one woman did say, you know, if more things come out, then they'll probably have to let him go. So even someone who's a hardcore fan of Brian Williams is conceding the fact that enough is enough, and that you can only, if you only have one or two incidences, we can accept that, and maybe that's, you know, they're aberrations. But more than that, no. And I think we got more than that. But we'll see what happens. Stay tuned, as they say. Hey, the Tony nominations came out, and there were a couple of surprises. The biggest surprises or snubs went to a shutout for both Finding Neverland, Harvey Weinstein's Broadway version of the movie. It's doing well, supposedly, at the box office, so he doesn't need the Tony nomination. But I think it's gotten pretty good reviews, too. So interesting that wasn't nominated for anything. And Larry David shut out, A Fish in the Dark. No nods, acting, or best play. Intriguing. But the nominees, it's going to be a tight year, it sounds like, because there are a couple of really good shows out there. The best musical nominees are An American in Paris, Fun Home, Something Rotten, and The Visit, and really not a clear frontrunner there. Best play, also a tight race, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, Disgrace, Hand to God, and Wolf Hall, Parts 1 and 2. I'm thinking it's going to be between Hand to God and The Curious Incident, although the edge probably goes to The Curious Incident. But we'll see. Campaigning like they do for the Oscars will be underway any minute. Best Musical Revival, The King and I, On the Town, and On the 20th Century. Best Play Revival, The Elephant Man, Skylight, This Is Our Youth, and You Can't Take It With You. Some actors in the mix, Stephen Boyer for Hand to God. Bradley Cooper got the nod for The Elephant Man, which was his dream role as a kid. Ben Miles, Wolf Hall, Parts 1 and 2, and Bill Nye, Skylight. Also Alex Sharp, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. Best Leading Actress in a Play, Geneva Carr, Hand to God. Helen Mirren, reviving her Oscar-winning performance as the Queen in The Audience. Elizabeth Moss for The Heidi Chronicles, which just closed due to lack of sales. Carey Mulligan, Skylight, and Ruth Wilson for Constellations. And we'll post the full list for you on our Twitter feed. So there you go. No big surprises. Lots of shows I want to see, so got to make it to Broadway. Here are the Drifters. I'm the Amy Beth Darkowicz. Reach out via Twitter, AB Wright. Phone line, 347-857-4505.
They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
On Broadway.
They say there's always magic in the air.
On Broadway.
But when you're walking down that street and you ain't had enough to eat, the glitter of light. They say the girls are
and we've got front row seats.
And intriguing shows to check out, for sure. Let's give a salute to our Inspiration Action Challenge success story, Millicent in Philadelphia, who says she's writing a crime novel. Hey, welcome to the club, Millicent. And she says, I started on and off working with the Inspiration Action Challenge 6 to 8 months ago, got into it, I did it on and off for a while, then 6 to 8 months ago, I got into it for sure, and it's working for me in a great way. I'm back in a real creative groove, and I thank you for giving the boost I really needed. Well, you're very welcome, Millicent. I'm glad it's working for you. Keep it up. Keep us posted. And if it's working for you, I'd love to give you a pat on the back. Just reach out to the website. It's amybetharkowee.com. That's also the place to go if you, it's not working so much for you. You need a little cajoling in the creative department. I think I can push you out of that ditch. No promises, but I think a creativity coaching, counseling conversation can help. And the first one's always on me, so let's get started. Give me a week or so to get back to you, and we'll help push you in the right direction, I hope. Do that. In the meantime, if you're looking for a job, hey, I've got one for you. This is a high-paying gig. You can make up to, get this, $175 an hour to become a playdate valet. You squire little tykes around in SUVs from one playdate to another, I guess, in New York City, through this group called Red Carpet Kids. It's a service that also provides two women gussied up as fairies who read bedtime stories for $350 an hour. Hey, I want that gig. I guess that's when the parents are just too busy or too tipsy to spend time with their little progeny. I don't know, just get the kids, go free range. That whole topic of free range parenting sounds good. And besides, probably the iWatch could provide entertainment and babysitting, don't you think?
I dream of a watch I have seen. It seems Apple made it so lean. So now I can wear on a wristband what once took a gigantic screen. I'll do everything that I need at 2 times the previous speed. I'll check Wikipedia entries in type that's so small I can't see. This is my wish, to wear on my wrist a watch that's half iPad and satellite dish, to fight for the right to keep both my eyes pinned on my 1-inch new streaming from Netflix of Gone with the Wind. And I know to my watch I'll be true, 'cause I know in the end it consumes everything that I do. Now it's my only friend. And the world is far better, except there's one thing I hope I don't mind. It seems Apple left off one feature. This watch cannot tell me the time.
Well, this is it. This is it. I'm living it, baby.
Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be free, be free. 'Cause there's a million things to be, you know that there are. And if you want to live high, live high. And if you want to live low, live low. 'Cause there's a million ways to go, you know that there are. What you want, the opportunity's on. And if you find a new way, you can do it today. You can make it all true, and you can make it undo. You see, it's easy. You only need to know. Well, if you want to say yes, say yes. And if you want to say no, say no. 'Cause there's a million ways to go, you know that there are. And if you want to be me, be me. And if you want to be you, be you. But there's a million things to do, you know that there are. You can do what you want, the opportunity's on. And if you find a new way, you can do it today. You can make it all true, and you can make it undo. You see, ah, it's easy. Ah, you only need to know. Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be free, be free. 'Cause there's a million things to be. You know that there are, 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 you know that there are.
There are a million ways to be. The Creativity Credo from Cat Stevens, sing out on the Amy Beth Arkley Show and the Cap Stats taking on Apple's iWatch. I'm waiting for the new model because I think it's going to make you dinner and babysit the kids, too. So that'll save you a whole bunch of money on Playdate valets. It is the Amy Beth Arkley Show. Hey, thank you so much for joining us. Catherine Lee Scott, find out more about her books and intriguing chapters in her acting career as well and writing career at CatherineLeeScott.com. I will post the link on my Twitter feed as soon as we get off the show. So that sounds like a lot of fun. Speaking of which, don't forget to friend me on Facebook. You can follow me on Twitter at AB Writes, our producer Trudy Hart at Radio Trudy. And I guess
that's
we're almost
the
ready
last
to wind
straw.
Is it?
If that's not enough to get you out of bed, something's seriously wrong.
Wow, that was like a miracle.
One of those performances that I will never, ever forget.
We want you to have a great damn day.
That inspired me to be a better person.
Please have a great damn day. We really want you to do it. Don't forget, if you miss any of the shows, they're all archived for podcast. Follow the Amy Beth Arkley Show at the Blog Talk Radio site. You can download episodes there, also at iTunes, NetNow, and at my website, amybetharkley.com. I want you to drive safe, play nice, dream big. Please come back and see us on the Amy Beth Arkley Show. Yes, Trudy, I'm going to do it. Leave you with the classic, because we did talk with a mystery author, Jerry Lewis. Take care. We'll talk on Friday.
Isn't that beautiful? I love a murder mystery upon the radio. I love it, I love it, I really love it so. The heroine is yelling while the sponsor goes on selling.
Don't touch me, you brute!
Use delirium for your tube.
Sam shovels in the hovel, he must grovel for a clue. I love it, I love it, I rally, rally do.
Sherlock Holmes, the giver's arms, interrupted by the sponsor. You see Watson, when the villain.
Painless Joe, do your drilling.
I'm nervous when I turn the dial, I'm dizzy in the head. When it's time for in a stankum, I go underneath my bed.
Don't shoot me, Biggs the Stoolie, as they put him through the mill.
I'll shoot you, seriously, I will. The girl he tries to take, and then we have a station break.
Come on, baby, come to me. Boing, boing, boing. This is Station C-O-D.
He's not breathing, but how can he? He's dead. He's dead! Why, this is a job for Superman, or Hopalong Cavity, or Jack Headstrong, the All-American Boy, or Jerry Lewis. But I don't scare easily, not me. I'm too frightened to be scared. I'll find the killer. I'll search the apartment. Aha! Just as I thought. Three shoes under the bed. Well, that's logical for a man with 3 feet.
But I have it now, Inspector. I can name your killer for you. His name is...
Painless Joe will do you drilling. My flesh begins to creep and then my skin begins to crawl. You think I was a worm the way I wiggled down the hall. I love a murder mystery upon the radio. I love it, I love it, I really love it so. I love it when I'm listening late at night and a murderer murderer is stalking a heroine, and a hero is stalking a murderer, and a private eye is stalking a hero, and a cop is stalking a private eye, and they're coming in closer and closer, surely, but closer and surely. They're coming out of the radio. Now they're stalking me. What have I done? I was only listening to the radio. Now they're throwing toothpaste at me. They're coming closer and closer. And I don't know the conjunctive moves of anyone that may be based on the fact that other people may say their facts. Where else are Crescendo? And certainly not the one in Rio. I'm not going to know that anyone else may say I'm wrong. And I feel that I must stay here now. No one else will ever know the facts.
I wish I was dead.